There's a lot of debate these days about the role of the US dollar as the global reserve currency. There is one country on Earth, the United States, that has the ability to print the global reserve currency. The US dollar is still used in the vast majority of international trade, and it is still held as the main asset in foreign exchange reserves of central banks around the world. And this has given the United States the ability to essentially export inflation to the rest of the world and to maintain a massive trade deficit with the rest of the world. For decades, the US has imported significantly more than it has produced. And the benefit that the US gets from having its currency as the global reserve currency has been referred to as an exorbitant privilege. This is a term that was popularized by France in the 1960s and is still used today. This issue has become especially important as more and more countries around the world are talking about de-dollarization, in particular with the return of inflation in the US with massive government deficits, and also with geopolitical conflict, with the US waging a new Cold War on China and Russia. And the US has also seized the foreign exchange reserves of Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and Afghanistan, and more countries around the world are seeking alternatives to the dollar. So this has led economists to debate just what the consequences would be for the United States if the dollar is unseated as the global reserve currency. As we move into a more multipolar world, other currencies are being used for international trade and being held in central bank reserves, and other assets like gold have become very popular for foreign central banks. Well, today I'm going to be looking at a very interesting study that was published by the Irish economist Philip Pilkington, and he tried to answer this question, and he analyzed what would be the effects on the US economy of the end of the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar. And he found that it would result likely in a decline in the average daily income in the US of between 27% and 57%. And he estimated that a decline of 27% would be more likely. This would mean a massive fall in living standards, and the US would no longer be able to maintain such a massive trade deficit with the rest of the world, such a huge current account deficit. It means that there would be more inflation. It means that imports would be more expensive. And in particular, the point I want to emphasize today is it would mean that wealthy investors who have invested so much in assets in the United States would see a huge blow to their wealth. That is to say, the people who would hurt the most from the end of the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar is the global 1%. The 1% of capitalist oligarchs in the US, but also the 1% of wealthy oligarchs around the world who have invested so much of their wealth in US assets. And for decades, since the rise of neoliberalism in the 1980s, the US government's policy has been to inflate asset prices at the expense of manufacturing. This resulted in severe deindustrialization in the United States and the loss of many good manufacturing jobs, many of which were unionized. And at the same time, the global 1%, which hold many of their assets in US dollar assets in the US, they have gotten very, very wealthy. In fact, you can see some of the effects of this in this study that was published by the economist Philip Pilkington. It is titled Reindustrialization in the Age of Fragmentation. It is a fascinating report, and I'm going to go through some of the main findings of it today. And for people who don't know, I should point out that Philip is the co-host of a very interesting podcast called the Multipolarity Podcast. And I sometimes disagree with them politically, but I think they have very interesting analysis, and it's definitely worth checking out. And as you can see in this study, Philip is quite a good economist, and I think he has a very unique perspective. He's very critical of the neoliberal financialization policies that have deindustrialized much of the West, and you can see that in the results of his study. Now, in the appendix of this report, which I'm going to look at before going to the rest of the study, he talks about what the United States would look like after the decline of the global dollar. And he points out that the United States is an extreme outlier when it comes to the relationship between its current account deficit and its income level. Most countries in the world that have significant current account deficits tend to have lower income levels. But the US stands out as an extreme outlier due to the unique status of the American dollar as the global reserve currency. You can visualize this if you look at World Bank data on the current account balances of countries around the world. And for people who don't know, the current account is a way to measure the balance of payments of a country, the way it trades with the rest of the world. And essentially, if a country has a current account surplus, it means that it exports significantly more than it imports. And if a country has a current account deficit, it means that it imports much more than it exports. So it's a way of measuring a country's trade deficit or surplus with the entire world, because a country can have a trade surplus with another country, but still have an overall current account deficit with the rest of the world. And if you look at this data, you can see that the countries that have the largest current account deficits in nominal terms, in dollar terms, are the wealthy Anglo-American countries, in particular, the United States and the United Kingdom. And you can see that in 2022, the US current account deficit was $971 billion. That is about $1 trillion. And the United Kingdom's current account deficit was about $100 billion. And in the World Bank data, the countries that are in light blue have a current account deficit, and the countries that are in dark blue have a current account surplus. And you can see the countries that are industrial superpowers that significantly rely on exports, like for instance, China, also Germany, Japan, they tend to have very large current account surpluses. And also petrostates, countries that export a lot of oil and gas or other important natural resources or minerals, also tend to have pretty large current account surpluses, like Russia or Saudi Arabia, for instance. However, that data was simply looking at the current account balance in nominal terms, in dollar terms. If you look at current account balances as a percentage of GDP, you can start seeing this pattern more clearly, where the countries that have a significant industrial base and export a lot of machines and capital goods tend to have current account surpluses. And also petrostates, countries that export a lot of raw materials, have current account surpluses. And in general, poor countries tend to have current account deficits because many poor developing countries do not have a significant developed industrial base, and they rely on importing things like machines, technology, capital goods, medicines, and instead they export only low value-added products and maybe some raw materials. So in general, the more advanced rich countries tend to have a higher current account surplus or more of a balance, whereas poor countries tend to overall have more of a current account deficit, except for one huge exception being the United States, which in 2022 had a current account deficit of 4% of GDP, compared to, for instance, Germany, which had a current account surplus of 4% of GDP. And this is even clearer if you look at the data over years. This map shows the current account balance of countries around the world between 1980 and 2008. And you can see that there is one country that is dark red on this map because it has by far the largest current account deficit in the entire world, and that is the United States. Whereas countries with large manufacturing sectors, especially China, Japan, Germany, they are some of the darkest green on this map with some of the largest current account surpluses because they are the factories of the world exporting significantly more than they import. Now, for people who don't know much about economics, I want to briefly explain this point because it's very important. Countries that tend to maintain a current account deficit over time often have a decline in living standards because they tend to have a falling exchange rate. What does that mean? It means that a country that imports much more than it exports has to find a way to finance that difference, right? Because if a country is paying for all of these imports, where is the money going to come from in order to pay for those imports? Well, workers can produce products and they can have exports. And then when they export products, they will get access to foreign currencies, which they can use to pay for their imports. However, if a country does not have enough of those foreign currencies to pay for the imports and they have a current account deficit, what happens is that over time, their currency will fall in value against the value of the currency that is used to pay for their imports, which, by the way, tends to be the dollar. So poor countries in the global south that tend to have current account deficits because they don't have much industry, their currencies often fall against the dollar. And that means that the purchasing power of workers who are paid in the local currency falls. That means that these workers can no longer buy imports, so imports decrease. And over time, theoretically, at least on paper, the balance of trade will become more balanced and the current account deficit will disappear. However, what actually happens is that countries take on debt in order to maintain those imports. And one of the ways in which governments will fund that debt is by selling sovereign debt in the form of bonds, or the International Monetary Fund will step in and they will help a country by providing them this debt that they use, this loan, in order to fund their balance of payments. But of course, they have to do so in return for imposing, you know, structural adjustment policies, which are demanded by the IMF. Now, the reason that the US does not have to do that, the IMF is never going to tell the US to balance its balance of payments and stop importing so much. The IMF is never going to impose conditionalities and structural adjustment on the US because the US dollar is the global reserve currency. So this means that most countries, poor countries in the global south, the living standards of workers fall because they can no longer pay for their imports, so their currencies devalue against the dollar. But the US is buying its imports with its own currency. If the US wants to buy foreign cars or oil or whatever technology they want now, then the US can simply print those dollars in order to import those products, and then the US exports inflation to the rest of the world. This is the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar. And in his report, Philip Pilkington tried to answer the question, what would the US economy look like in a world where the US dollar is no longer the global reserve currency? And he found that it would result in living standards in the US, that is average daily income, falling to an equilibrium level of about 57%. And that is a massive decline. However, he points out that wealthier countries are often better able to sustain higher living standards than poorer countries relative to their current account balance. So in reality, he estimated that it would probably look like a decline of living standards of around 27%. So between 27 and 57%. What this shows is that the US economy is living on the wealth produced by other economies around the world, and the US economy sucks in that wealth in the form of foreign investments, which are used to fund its current account deficit. However, at the same time, I think there's a very important detail in here, which is the role of financialization in the US economy, and how looking simply at a decline in the average daily income of Americans, I think, is not the best way to understand this, because we should understand how, yes, the end to the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar will have an impact on average people in the US, but actually what we're going to see is different impacts on different people in the US. And the people who will be hurt the most from the end of the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar are not poor and working class Americans, but the richest Americans. And also rich people around the world, the global 1% who hold much of their wealth in the form of US dollar denominated assets. Because the reality is that the financialization of the US economy and the deindustrialization of the US economy and the role of the US dollar as the global reserve currency has not benefited most average working people. Instead, it has benefited a small handful of capitalist oligarchs. And this is why the issue of industrialization is so important. Because if you look, when the U.S. in the neoliberal era in the 1980s, when it began to deindustrialize, it's not a coincidence that that's the same moment at which the U.S. current account balance began to skyrocket. So in the 1970s, the U.S. current account balance was around balanced. It was about 0% of GDP, pretty balanced. But by the 1980s, in 1987, it fell to 3% of GDP. And then in the 1990s, it plummeted. And by 2006, it reached 6% of GDP. This is, of course, right before the Great Recession in the United States, the major financial crisis, which this is peak globalization, peak neoliberal globalization. And in this era, from the 1980s until the 2000s, 2010s, many manufacturing jobs in the United States were exported abroad. This is the era of outsourcing. And instead, the U.S. economy increasingly financialized. This chart shows how in the neoliberal era of globalization and free market fundamentalism, there was a bifurcation. And you can see it very clearly in the average compensation in the non-financial sector and in the financial sector. And wages for non-financial workers in the U.S. were completely stagnant since the beginning of the financialized neoliberal era. And instead, in the financial sector, compensation skyrocketed. And this chart, by the way, comes from the U.S. government's inquiry, its official commission report on the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And it's a very clear example of the adverse effect, the negative effects of this neoliberal financialization policy along with deindustrialization. Here's another chart showing how starting in the 1980s, there was this bifurcation and the U.S. economy moved much more toward the service sector and away from goods and construction, away from manufacturing. And basically, the idea was that the U.S. doesn't need to produce anything. Instead, U.S. companies can outsource their manufacturing to low-wage countries in the global south, and they can pay foreign workers much less and then export those goods to the United States. And instead, the U.S. economy would be based much more on services and, in particular, in the financial sector. And the idea was essentially that all forms of economic activity and economic growth are equally valuable. It doesn't matter that there is less manufacturing in the U.S. So this brings us back to the issue of the U.S. current account deficit and helps us to answer the question as to why the U.S. has been able to maintain such a massive current account deficit over decades. It makes more sense when you realize that the inverse of the current account is the capital account. The capital account is the way to measure the flow of investment into and out of a country. And you can see that as the U.S. maintained this trade deficit with the rest of the world, the U.S. began exporting dollars. It flooded the world with dollars. And what happened? Those dollars were invested in assets in the United States. Now, it also led to the creation of offshore dollar accounts in Europe, which are known as euro dollars in other countries as well. But that's a completely different point. What we're looking at here from the Federal Reserve data is the massive increase in foreign investment in U.S. assets, which are the inverse of the U.S. trade deficit with the rest of the world. You can see that in the 1960s and 70s, it was basically balanced. If anything, there was actually a capital account deficit. But in the neoliberal era, with the lifting of capital controls, allowing capital to move freely all around the world, and with the end of the pegging of the US dollar to gold, and with outsourcing of manufacturing jobs and deindustrialization, the global 1% capitalists around the world begin to invest more and more of their wealth in U.S. assets, which is what was funding the United States and helping it to maintain its current account deficit. You can see this especially clearly if you look at the size of the U.S. stock market as a percentage of the overall world stock market. Now, in 1899, the U.S. represented a little under 15% of the world stock market. The UK made up 24%. As of 2024, the US alone represents nearly 61% of the entire world stock market. This is according to data that was published by the Swiss bank UBS in its Global Investment Returns Yearbook for 2024. And you can see that no other country comes even remotely close. Japan comes in second place with 6% of the size of the entire world stock market. The US is 10 times larger. What this shows is that not only capitalists in the US, but capitalists around the world hold much of their wealth in the form of US equities, and also, of course, US real estate and US bonds, US government debt. It was famously the economist Michael Hudson who explained how this system works back in the 1970s in his book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire. And Michael published an updated third edition of his book back in 2021. He explained how the US was able to maintain this current account deficit by forcing other countries to invest in US Treasury securities, especially US allies like Japan and South Korea that have been militarily occupied by the US since, in the case of Japan, the 1940s, and in the case of South Korea, since the 1950s. So essentially, these countries were paying the US to maintain its military occupation of them. And furthermore, other countries around the world began holding large sums of US Treasury securities, US debt, because also the US dollar is the global reserve currency, and also because of the petrodollar system that the US helped to create in the 1970s by pressuring Saudi Arabia to price its oil in dollars and pressuring other oil producers to price their oil in dollars. And this means that if you hold treasury securities, it's also like holding oil, essentially. So after US President Richard Nixon ended the convertibility of the dollar into gold in 1971, the way that the US was able to finance its increasing current account deficit is through this increasing debt that it has with the rest of the world that is financed by foreign investors, in the case of central banks, but also in the case of wealthy capitalists, holding their wealth in the form of US dollar denominated assets. And the policy of the US government has essentially been to inflate the value of these assets, especially the stock market. You can see the massive asset price inflation during the quantitative easing, in which the Federal Reserve essentially printed money and used it to buy securities and inflate the value of assets. And the stock exchange in the US, the major top 500 companies in the stock exchange, saw their stock prices massively increase by more than 400% between 2009 and 2019. And there was also a very significant increase in the value of real estate in the US, which grew significantly faster than wages in the US. So what this shows is that the US government's policy was no longer about serving the interests of working people. Instead, the US government was dedicated to protecting the wealth of the global 1% of capitalists in the US and capitalists around the world, inflating their assets, while at the same time, the cost of living became more and more expensive for average working class people in the US. This is why I emphasized earlier that the end of the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar does not necessarily mean that working people in the US will suddenly all become extremely poor, because in reality, the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar was used to maintain the wealth of the global capitalist class, not the wealth of average working people. And at the same time, we should keep in mind that this inflation of asset prices in the US on behalf of the global 1% also meant that the US was unable to compete in terms of its industry because the cost of living became so prohibitively expensive, especially with the privatization of education and healthcare and transportation. This meant that it became extremely expensive for manufacturing production in the US. So as de-dollarization happens, as the US loses the exorbitant privilege of the dollar, it also makes it easier for reindustrialization in the US. It makes it easier to bring back manufacturing jobs, which also, by the way, tend to be much better, high quality jobs for working people. And by the way, many of those manufacturing jobs will probably be unionized. Unions tend to be much stronger when it comes to factory manufacturing work. And it's not a coincidence that when the US deindustrialized in the 1980s and 90s, part of that was motivated by these US multinational corporations wanting to break the back of unions, which were very strong up until that period. And this brings me back to the report that was published by the economist Philip Pilkington, because I want to look at a few other details which are related to this. Philip correctly points out that the deindustrialization in the US and the West more broadly coincided with the rise of a so-called post-industrial economy and financialization, with the so-called new economy boom of the 1990s. He doesn't use the term neoliberalism, but this is what we're talking about. Free market fundamentalism, the idea that all forms of economic activity are the same, that speculating on financial assets is just as important as manufacturing cars and, you know, building infrastructure. And Philip correctly points out that this rampant financialization led to the inflation of financial bubbles. In the US, for instance, in 2000, there was the dot-com bubble. And in 2008, there was the popping of the housing and mortgage bubble and the Great Recession. This report notes that this led to the economic abandonment of formal industrial regions, like, for instance, the Steel Belt and the Rust Belt in the United States, or also Northern England was another deindustrialized area. And with the rise of free market economics, with neoliberal dogma being embraced by both Democrats and Republicans, there was a significant loss of highly paid manufacturing jobs. Now, Philip Pilkington doesn't point out that many of those jobs were unionized. And one of the reasons they were so highly paid is because they were unionized, and that US companies were trying to break the back of unions. But it's a very important point, and I'm glad to see that he is drawing together the financialization and the deindustrialization, because these two phenomena are direct mirrors of each other. And Pilkington has a chart in here that shows manufacturing employment as a percentage of all jobs in the US. And you can see that there was a big increase during World War II. It reached nearly 40%. And in the 1950s, manufacturing jobs were more than 30% of all of the jobs in the US. But there was a significant decline. And by the 2010s, it stagnated. And today, manufacturing jobs only represent around 8% of total jobs in the US. And now the US is trying to bring back some of those manufacturing jobs. But it's not just the US. With the rise of neoliberalism, market fundamentalism across the West, you can see that there is a general decline in manufacturing output in the West. And at the same time, we see an increase in manufacturing production in the BRICS countries, and especially China being the largest economy in the BRICS, the largest economy in the world, and also the world's industrial superpower. Now, I should point out that in his report, Pilkington included Japan and South Korea in the West, the collective West grouping. And that makes sense politically, of course. Although when you include Japan and South Korea in the data, it actually makes the deindustrialization look less bad. Because in reality, compared to Europe and the US, Japan and South Korea have not deindustrialized. Japan and South Korea are still major industrial powers. So you should keep this in mind when we're looking at the data here, that Japan and South Korea are actually helping the West in this data. Now, also coinciding with deindustrialization in the West was a decline in investment. And economists measure investment by looking at gross fixed capital formation. And if you look at gross fixed capital formation as a percentage of GDP, you can see that the countries that are major industrial powers like China and also South Korea still have very high investment rates. In the case of China, it is nearly 45% of GDP. In South Korea, it is over 30% of GDP. But in the US and the UK, the, you know, neoliberal financialized economies, in the US, it's just over 20%. And in the UK, it is under 20% of GDP. So there was a massive decline in investment, And of course, you need investment in order to fund more industrial production and reindustrialize. What's also very interesting about this study is that Pilkington looked at foreign direct investment, FDI, as a percentage of GDP, and he shows that actually there's not really a correlation between manufacturing, high levels of manufacturing as a percentage of GDP, and FDI as a percentage of GDP. In fact, China's FDI as a percentage of GDP is very low. It's at basically the same level as the US, and it's lower than the UK's. But obviously the US and the UK have significantly deindustrialized, whereas China continues to industrialize. So Pilkington points out that this data shows that developing countries mainly rely for their capital development on internal capital accumulation, whereas Western countries typically seek out a combination of domestic and foreign capital to build out their capital stock. So FDI is not as important for the BRICS countries as it is for many of the Western countries. And of course, this is looking at data from 2017 until 2022. There was a period, especially in the 90s and 2000s, in which FDI was more important for China's economy. But today, FDI is not very important for China's economy. And you should keep this in mind when Western media outlets try to portray China as being an economic crisis because FDI has declined, ignoring the fact that the vast majority of investment is domestic, not foreign. In fact, Pilkington pointed out in his report that it is foreign investors who stand to the most to gain out of investment in rapidly growing emerging economies, not the economies themselves, many of which seem able to grow without FDI inflows. And he pointed out that the relationship between average income and FDI is very weak. He shows that the data, according to the data, average income does not correlate with foreign direct investment. And people might think that the main driver of FDI is low labor costs, but the data shows that other factors must override this consideration. Low labor costs alone are not enough to attract foreign direct investment, and high labor costs are not enough to repel FDI. And this is often pointed out by economists. If the only thing that you needed to attract foreign direct investment was low wages, then the poorest countries in the world, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, would have tons of FDI. But obviously there are other considerations like infrastructure, industrialization, human capital development. So the point is that this idea that developing countries need to attract foreign capital from foreign investors in order to develop is simply not the case. In the case of China, FDI did play a role in technology transfer, but it was not the main factor in China's economic development. And today, it is not the main factor in development in the BRICS countries and in much of the global south. The vast majority of investment in these countries is domestic, not foreign. And by the way, in regard to this idea that having low wages means that a country is going to have better manufacturing, well, what's interesting about Pilkington's report is he finds that average daily income bears no relationship to manufacturing as a percentage of GDP. So that means that having a low wage economy is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for having a large manufacturing component in a country's economy. There is, however, a consistent relationship in both Western economies and in the BRICS countries between running a current account surplus and having a higher average daily income. So this is simply explaining the data we looked at earlier, which shows that many poor countries, developing countries in the global south, have current account deficits, whereas some rich countries disproportionately tend to have current account surpluses. But of course, as we're talking about today, the main exception is the US, and that's because of the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar. Pilkington says this in his report, noting that having a globally competitive economy that can run a trade surplus gives rise to higher living standards. However, the situation of the United States is an outlier. The US may have too high an average income relative to its international competitiveness, and that is an effect of the US dollar being the global reserve currency. If the dollar were ever to lose its reserve currency status, the US may see a substantial contraction in living standards. This, of course, is the main point of the analysis today that I began this episode with. And I think it's the most interesting finding in Pilkington's study, although it's not the only one. This is a very fascinating report. And as I wrap up, Pilkington concluded his study pointing out that a small but vocal minority of economists and politicians have warned about the dangers of deindustrialization for decades, but were not taken seriously by the political elite. And that's, of course, because they profited from the financialization of the U.S. economy. And not just the U.S. political elite, but around the world elites profited from that, from investing in U.S. dollar-denominated assets. However, the silver lining that he points out in this study, which again, the study was actually not dedicated to studying the exorbitant privilege of the dollar. That was actually kind of a side effect of this report. What it was dedicated to is looking at the effects of deindustrialization and how Western countries can reindustrialize and whether or not high incomes have an impact on industrialization. And he pointed out that high labor costs are not impossible to marry with high levels of investment in industrialization, as countries like Japan and Germany have shown, but at the same time, they likely do not make industrialization any easier, and Western countries that have lower wages have an advantage in the reindustrialization drive. However, he points out that it is possible to reindustrialize, that governments have to encourage higher rates of investment. And this is, I think, the money quote. There needs to be a concerted effort on the part of government to channel savings into productive investment rather than blowing bubbles in the financial markets. This is such an important point, and this is exactly getting back to the issue that I've been speaking about today, which is that U.S. government policy since the rise of neoliberalism in the 1980s has not been to encourage productive investment in the real economy. Instead, the U.S. government's goal has been to inflate the value of assets held by the global 1% by capitalists in the U.S. and around the world, and has done so at the expense of the industrial sector and good, high-quality manufacturing jobs in the U.S. And this is why the end of the exorbitant privilege of the U.S. dollar can be good for working people around the world. In the U.S. and other countries, it is the global capitalist class, oligarchs worldwide, the world, global 1%, who have benefited from the exorbitant privilege of the U.S. dollar. And this is why de-dollarization is so important, not only for developing countries that want to have they want to increase the living standards of their own workers and want to have a greater share in global prosperity. They, of course, are the main beneficiaries of de-dollarization, and that's why it's so important for them to find alternatives to the dollar. But also, I think it's true that there could be benefits for working people in the U.S. This is why everyone should support de-dollarization, and it's also why I spend so much time and energy reporting on this issue. I think de-dollarization is one of the most important developments in global politics and economics today. And on that note, I'm going to conclude. I'm Ben Norton, the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. I want to thank everyone for joining me today. Please like and subscribe. Oh, and by the way, in the description below, I have linked to Philip Pilkington's very interesting report. You can find that link below and read the study for yourself. On that note, I'm going to conclude. I'll see you all next time.